English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran warns the European Union against irrational acts of meddling over recent riots in the country, saying it will respond in kind to any new measures by the bloc. Several explosions hit a central area in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, amid reports of intense fighting between Russian and Ukrainian forces in Donbass. And Brazil's incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro and his leftist challenger Lula da Silva trade jabs. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Tehran is warning the European Union against irrational acts of meddling against Iran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Iran will respond in kind to any new measure by the bloc or its member states. Kanani is also slamming European countries for applying double standards to riots in Iran and elsewhere. Kanani says that they are calling on Iran not to counter riots while they countered rioters in their own countries. Some European officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest that followed the death of a young Iranian woman last month. The European Council is set to discuss the issue in a meeting on Monday and could impose sanctions on Iran. The Iranian judiciary says four more inmates have died due to the blaze at Tehran's Evin prison on Friday. The prisoners were earlier said to be in critical condition. Their deaths take the number of lives lost in the fire incident to eight. The judiciary earlier said dozens of inmates were also injured. The blaze started at the prison sewing workshop following a brawl involving a group of prisoners. Meanwhile, security guards said that they foiled an attempt by prisoners to break out by some inmates convicted of violent and dangerous crimes. The situation has now returned to normal. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched a military drill in border areas in the northwestern provinces of Iran. The exercises are conducted by the IRGC's ground force in the Aras River region, which borders Azerbaijan and Armenia. On the agenda of the drills are heli-borne operations, night combat, and river crossing exercises. Among others, helicopters and various types of drones will also be deployed. The ground forces commander, Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpour, says the exercise is part of their scheduled annual missions aimed at boosting their combat readiness. Pakpour says the drills send a message of peace and friendship to neighbors and a message of a warning to enemies that armed forces will give a firm response to any threat. The British capital, London, has hosted this year's annual Islamic Unity Conference. The event brings together religious leaders of various Muslim sects together under the roof to promote peace and combat division. This year's conference comes amid a global campaign targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran. Robert Carter reports.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Walayat al-Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
Several explosions have hit the Ukrainian capital for the second time in a week, damaging several residential buildings. Officials say that the city was struck five times in early morning hours. Kiev's mayor says that at least three people are killed and several others have been hospitalized. Separately, officials in Ukraine's eastern region have said that a big fire broke out at an energy facility there after a missile hit it. Meanwhile, Ukraine's prime minister says Russian strikes target critical infrastructure in three regions, knocking out electricity to hundreds of towns and villages across the country. Russian and Ukrainian forces are also engaged in heavy fighting around Donetsk and Lugansk in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. We talked to our correspondent Johnny Miller from Donetsk with more on the latest attacks.
In Kiev today, we're woken up by the sound of a Russian bombing of the capital. It's not clear all the targets yet. You mentioned the train station. It's also looks like it's been confirmed that the headquarters of the main Ukrainian energy company has also been hit. This is in line with Russia's new policy to start hitting civil infrastructure and particularly power stations, energy infrastructure. This, of course, helps to inhibit Ukraine's ability on the battlefield, but also will make life more difficult for civilians. So, as you mentioned, Russia has been hitting Kiev and other cities increasingly over the last week, and that looks like it'll set to continue. Countries are calling for their citizens to leave Kiev as the expectation that this bombing will continue.
A senior Russian official warns Israel against supplying weapons to Ukraine, saying it would destroy all bilateral ties between Tel Aviv and Moscow. Deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says that it would be very reckless for Israel to deliver arms to Kiev. Ukraine has asked Israel for military supplies, including the Iron Dome anti-missile system. Israeli officials are yet to grant the request. However, the Israeli prime minister has criticized Russia after it launched a barrage of missiles against Ukrainian cities last week. Clashes have erupted between French police and angry demonstrators who rallied in the capital, Paris, to protest against soaring living costs and climate inaction. Police used tear gas and pepper spray to disperse the protesters, who in return threw objects at security forces. The protesters were also pushing against proposed pension reforms. The demonstration was called by left-wing political parties backed by hundreds of associations. France has already been hit by weeks of refinery strikes that have caused fuel shortages across the country. The workers demand wage hikes to cover inflation and include a share of the huge profits made by oil companies. The prime minister has warned the striking industry workers that the government might use force to bring them back to their jobs in order to ease the fuel shortages. Local commentator John Stepling explains how the people in France are finding it difficult to get by with the ongoing cost of living crisis.
The cost of living has risen so precipitously. The gas prices are amazingly high, even in Scandinavia here. Food prices have risen far beyond anything that's actually even reported. And again, this is true even in a country like Norway. So people are reaching a point where it's not sustainable for them. And winter, of course, is coming, and the prospect of having to heat your house in the winter months, especially in northern European countries, is causing people a great deal of anxiety. And the governments of Europe have no answer for this. In the EU, Ursula von der Leyen just keeps repeating the same sort of mantra about we have to send weapons and money to Ukraine and so forth. Prices are just unrealistically high. I mean, impossible for people to survive if they stay at this level. Impossible for them to heat their homes in winter if they stay at this level. Just literally impossible.
As the energy crisis continues to bite in Italy, people from all walks of life have been staging protests across the country, from students to workers. Italians are urging the next government to put the community back in the center of political discourse and work for peace. Max Civilli reports.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civilli, Rome.
Top EU diplomat Josep Borrell is under increasing fire for a recent analogy that he made in it. He drew what many have described as a racist and offensive contrast between Europe and the rest of the world. The remarks sent social media into a frenzy. Let's take a listen to some of those reactions. But first, this is Josep Borrell himself.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it in order to protect the garden. The gardeners have to go to the jungle. The European has to be much more engaged with the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means.
Is Africa still a jungle only meant to furnish someone else's garden, as it has painfully been so? You looted the jungle for generations to build your garden, sit down. Years ago, war criminal Prime Minister Ehud Barak described Israel as a village in the jungle. Today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes the EU as a garden in the jungle. These truly are the shared values of these putrid racist colonialists.
This racist's garden only grows because of everything he and those he represents steal from the jungle.
The candidates in Brazil's runoff presidential elections have traded jabs and insults in their first debate 2 weeks to go before the vote. Leftist challenger Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva attacked far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by calling him a little dictator and a king of fake news. Bolsonaro pushed back, calling Lula a national shame, and handling the COVID-19 and corruption were the main issues that were discussed. Meanwhile, according to the latest opinion polls, Lula enjoys 49% support and against 44% of Jair Bolsonaro. Both fall short of the 50% threshold needed to win the presidency in the first round of elections on October the 2nd. And South Korea begins new war games amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The South says that the joint drills with the U.S. and Japan are designed to boost their ability to respond to what the South calls North Korea's nuclear and missile threats. Last week, tensions flared after the North fired a missile, shot more than 500 artillery shells, and flew a multitude of warplanes near the inter-Korean border. Seoul condemned the move and imposed its first unilateral sanctions against Pyongyang in nearly 5 years. But the North has accused the South's military of escalating tensions with its own artillery fighting. Pyongyang says that its latest military activities are in response to military drills by South Korea and the United States. Pyongyang considers the war games as a rehearsal for an invasion.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The presidential elections have taken place in Brazil. Lula Inácio da Silva is still in the lead, but Bolsonaro is creeping up. It's gone off to the second round. What kind of economy would Brazil have under Bolsonaro or the incoming Lula Inácio da Silva? I am Kavitahwe. Welcome to this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the highlights that we'll be looking at in this program. First, Brazil under Bolsonaro. Personal income deficiency is one of the things that he's left behind so far. And food and fuel costs are soaring. At the same time, the country has been under Western, and in particular, the U.S. influence. What will happen if Lula comes into the picture? Well, Lula's economic plans to tame the inflation is one of them. He has also recommended a new currency by the name of Sur to be introduced, the reason to be free from the U.S. dollar. We'll see if that happens if Lula is elected. Also, some of the priorities of Lula da Silva. to deepen Latin American integration, also strengthen regional economic sovereignty, and closer BRICS bonding.
Brazil has just had a crucial presidential election. Left-winger Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has faced far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro.
Tenho esperança. Tenho muita esperança. Eu acho que agora vai. Eu acho que agora vai melhorar muito. Eu acho, né? Vamos esperar, né? Que Deus abençoe.
A gente conhece, sim, o governo dos dois, né? Eu não vou dizer que eu fiquei feliz com nenhum dos dois, mas o brasileiro ele tem esperança, né, por dias melhores, e a gente acredita que possa ser um governo melhor daqui para frente.
One key issue in this year's election has been the economy. During the tenure of the incumbent President Bolsonaro, Brazil's economic performance faced lots of ups and downs. After a strong recovery of 5% in 2021, GDP growth was expected to slow significantly in 2022 to 0.6%, before picking up to 1.2% in 2023. Rising inflation, the war in Ukraine, and tighter financial conditions have eroded economic sentiment and purchasing power. The poor performance was due to a number of factors, including the COVID-19 crisis, which killed thousands of people in Brazil. Reports now say that the specter of hunger is back in one of Brazil's federative units, which is now ranked 7th in the 2021 poverty index of 146 Brazilian municipalities. During 2021 and much of 2022, the annual inflation rate of Brazil was hovering in double digits. In August of this year, it dropped to about 9%, but food prices were still high. 34% of Brazilians said that they struggled to afford food at times in the past year. That's roughly 1 in 3 Brazilians. Furthermore, during Bolsonaro's term in office, 56% of Brazilians think that it was a bad time to find a job, and less than half saw local economic conditions improving. In the 2000s, the President Lula da Silva initiated a program called Bolsa Família and gave more rights to workers. The initiatives improved wage bargaining and led to the reduction of inequality across Brazil.
Taking a look at social media posts when it came to the presidential elections, of course, given the lead that Lula da Silva had established prior to the elections happening, many were posting positive remarks about him. But we try to cover both sides of the aisle and also where things may be headed when and if Lula is elected. Our first post, Lula should publicly name a moderate economist, as this particular post is saying, as his pick for finance minister to reassure, for example, farmers that he will not tolerate land invasions, promise not to nationalize any industries, and to rule out interfering with media freedom. Next up, a BRICS detail associated here, where it says the BRICS will strengthen amid new political conditions, remaining one of the principal instruments of the global economy. And that's according to the Russian ambassador to Brazil. Next, this post read, Brazilians head to the election on an improving economy. Factoring in weaker activity in the coming months, growth will be close to a robust 3% this year. We are more positive than consensus on 2023 prospects, as Brazil will likely maintain a sound microeconomic policy framework. So that shows, this particular post shows that Bolsonaro is not doing that badly then. But then we can see the opposite true here, whereas this post reads, why haven't Bolsonaro's polling numbers improved even as the economy got better in recent months?
The economy is still not in great shape for most people. There is an estimated 33 million Brazilians who are living with some kind of food insecurity and hunger. And in my 20 years of traveling to Brazil, I've never seen the homeless problem as acute as it is in major cities like Rio, Sao Paulo, and Brasilia. That, of course, is a symptom of much deeper ills elsewhere in the country.
Then moving on, this post reads, perhaps this may explain why Bolsonaro was bad for Brazil's economy.
Jair Bolsonaro is bad for Brazil's economy.
And Jair Bolsonaro, the president, are presiding not just over a return to fiscal incontinence, but also to other economic ills that have dogged Brazil, rising inflation, high interest rates, and low growth.
Okay, there you have some of the posts. The good and the bad when it comes to Brazil and Bolsonaro and, of course, Lula da Silva. Our first guest joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Bruno Biclini. He's a professor of international studies, holding a PhD in political science. Bruno Biclini, welcome to Economic Divide. When it comes to Bolsonaro's economic performance, we'd like to hear from you, where it is said that they have devastated Brazil's economy. Is that true? They have blamed the economic minister, Paulo Guedes, for that. But in particular, what indicators do you see in terms of how Brazil's economy has done under Bolsonaro?
We must understand that Bolsonaro economics is totally vinculated to the shock doctrine that was tried to be executed by his Minister of Economy, Paulo Guedes. Paulo Guedes is a real and original hardcore Chicago boy. He even worked at Chile during Pinochet's dictatorship. So he tried to apply a shock doctrine in Brazil. For example, incentivated allowing Petrobras to go forward on selling refineries. That's an example. There is no industrial policies. There is no high-tech policies. There is not even a policy vinculating or connecting high-level education to high-tech industrial park.
Okay, not obviously a good reading of Bolsonaro there. Let's see what Carlos Guerra Paiva thinks. He's an economist and who holds a PhD in economics at the University of Campinas. He's also the president of a Paradox consulting company who joins us. Carlos, welcome to Economic Divide. The elections in Brazil are looking at Lula going to the second round, but many are looking at Lula and they're very hopeful that he, for example, will bring down prices like he did with the massive social movements and transformation that he had when he was president for low-paid workers. Do you think that he's going to be able to do that again?
Well, as I tried to explain before, inflation rate in Brazil is already under control. And Lula would manage to keep it at a low level systematically once he really has an economic and development project, unlike Bolsonaro, whose economic policy is erratic and opportunistic. As a matter of fact, Lula's main challenge is another one. Since 1994, Brazil controls inflation by raising interest rates and valuing the domestic currency against the dollar. This system has proven to be effective to put inflation under control, but it's really perverse for the manufacturing industry.
It's time now for the Infinews section of the program. The first item concerns the relationship between the United States and Venezuela. It appears the U.S. is courting Venezuela and may offer sanctions relief to that country. Guess what? For oil. And it's reported that Chevron may be allowed to drill for crude if Caracas agrees, now here's the condition, to free and fair elections. Wonder what that means. Okay. Next up is a piece of news that is still making its rounds. And it has to deal with the OPEC Plus decision in which it decided to cut production by 2 million barrels per day. Now, this, as they explained, would shore up prices. But what's making news is the fact that OPEC Plus has defied U.S. pressure, in particular Saudi Arabia, which has been accused now of what's called weaponization of oil, something that Saudi Arabia has rebuked, in which it said, show me this hostile act. And that came from the Saudi energy minister in response to a claim from the U.S. media that it was using oil as a weapon. This story is not over, not by a long shot. Next up, this piece of news is important because of the fact that you have these regions that Russia was able to, through a referendum, have it rejoin Russia, in which at this point, after the referendum took place and the four regions rejoined Russia, it has set out the conditions that they will now go through. And one of the things it has said is that it will financially support these new regions. They compose of Donbass, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia, three of them, which is in the plans to be exempt from income tax for a period of 10 years. And also there are plans for the creation of a common free economic zone for those four regions. which are in the eastern part of Ukraine. And finally, our look is at poverty. World Bank has come out with a rather gruesome and really not very optimistic view of world poverty, that the goal of ending it by the year 2030 is now out of reach. It has cited the effects of the COVID pandemic, which is still lingering, and also the war in Ukraine, which will make it unlikely for the world to eradicate extreme poverty by the decade's end. Those were the stories that we picked for this edition of the Info News. If you have any stories from your part of the world, we would love to hear from you.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for an in-depth section of the program. In order to take a look at Brazil's economy, we need to see the report card that Bolsonaro has had and how he's going to handle, if he becomes president again, the economy moving forward, and of course then what Lula da Silva is going to be walking into. So we have picked certain segments of the economy which would be indicative of that in terms of the overall performance. Now, in terms of our first look, we take a look at Brazil's economy and the GDP and employment rate, both GDP per capita and productivity. It's 73% lower than the OECD's best performers. And again, taking a look at what has occurred, employment rate is low and was stagnating even before the 2020 crisis. The reference to the 2020 crisis is about how the COVID-19 hit. So the employment rate was low, and that is something that's going to be a challenge. Next up, the labor market, recovering slowly. The way we take a look at the unemployment rate and also the participation rate. In this case, in point, the one in the blue is the unemployment rate. The one in the maroon is the participation rate. And the labor market is recovering very slowly. The peak to have reached 15% between 2020 and 2021. And based on that dip over there, and that's when COVID-19 hit, which at this point is not really a good sign, because we still need to look at how it's recovering not as quickly as it should. Now, inflation, let's take a look at that, where here it shows that it has not peaked yet. Now, this comes despite monetary policy tightening. In terms of what we're looking at, that's important here. Well, they're all important, but the core inflation is where we focused in, which goes from a low of a little over 2% to shooting up all the way. It's on an upward trajectory there. And again, that's not a good sign. Next, something that needs to be taken a look at for any economy, really, and that's the inequality factor, which based on what we looked at, it's higher than in most advanced economies. In Brazil, the poorest 20% of households earn 3.1% of total income. And the range that we took a look at was 23.6 for the low inequality and very high inequality of 62. And that's the Gini coefficient. If you're asking what the Gini coefficient is, the coefficient measures the inequality among values of a frequency distribution, which we just I just outlined for you, and that is based in, as an example, on the levels of income. And moving on to our final look, we figured we'd take a look at consumer sentiment. It has deteriorated. The years 2016 through 2021 is our records, actually 2020, and it goes on to 2021. Consumer confidence is the one in the blue, and then the core inflation coming in the one in the maroon, which shows that the business confidence is not as high as should be. Lower confidence in both is due to things like higher inflation, perhaps tighter financial conditions, and COVID-19. Okay, if you're a bit confused, let's get more from our guests, which we will bring back here. First, we will have Bruno Biclini rejoining us, professor of international studies, and he has a PhD in political science. Bruno, welcome back. Taking a look at Brazil's Da Silva to propose a Latin American currency free of the U.S. dollar, because he says that Brazil can't keep depending on that, and he said that he would like there to be deeper Latin American integration and also strengthening of the region's economic sovereignty. With Brazil being part of BRICS, what does this shift away mean from the U.S. and the West?
I'm really not sure if establishing a continental currency would be a good idea, or at least would be executed in 2 to 4 years. But all of the regional alliances, all of the strategic coordinations we must spread out in Latin America, we must have this connection to the BRICS, to the BRICS Bank, to the BRICS Auxiliary Emergency Fund. And we must have the South Bank with full deposits. During doing this, we can get back to the other step, having the strategic coordination projects just like between the oil complex with Petrobras, PDVSA, EPF, EPFB from Bolivia. We also do have to develop again our industry and also our green industry, because otherwise all of our countries, including Brazil, would be for the international system only platforms to export agricultural commodities and minerals.
Indeed, green energy obviously is something that's high on the list of many economies. Rejoining us for our second guest is Carlos Agueda Paiva, economist and PhD in economics at the University of Campinas. He's also the president of Paradox Consulting Company. Carlos, welcome back. Brazil's Da Silva, in terms of this new currency that he wants to adopt, not a new thing. At the same time, he is looking to shift away from the U.S. dollar and also strengthen the country's relationship regionally. With Brazil being part of BRICS now, how do you think this shift will work?
Well, I do not believe that Lula and his economic advisors are effectively committed to the creation of a Latin American currency. In my opinion, he's just signaling two movements. First, the need to deepen Latin America's solidarity and the region's sovereignty with respect to the U.S. Second, its commitment to the BRICS, and in particular to Russia and China, which are at the heart of the articulation of a new world currency replacing the dollar. These flags are essentially correct, but their conquest is not just up to us.
Brazil's current president, Jair Bolsonaro, is a far-right leader who was a close ally of neoliberal politicians in Washington. He admired the former U.S. president, Donald Trump, and sought to implement economic policies in line with the interests of politicians in the U.S. Meanwhile, leftist Da Silva has proposed a currency for Latin America in order to rid the region from the economic hegemony of the U.S. and the U.S. dollar. The aim of the measure is to deepen Latin American integration and to strengthen the region's economic sovereignty. Brazil is also a key member in the BRICS group of countries, which includes Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Da Silva's potential victory could further push the Latin American nation away from the influence sphere of the U.S. and strengthen its alliance with the countries which are seeking to forge a new international world order.
One of the characteristics of the BRICS is that we are large developing countries which face many similar challenges. So we share these experiences and we learn from each other.
The BRICS have been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency, which could potentially replace the dollar to further weaken its global hegemony. Da Silva is a fierce supporter of a multipolar world, free from unilateral hegemony and from sterile bipolar confrontation.
Like it or not, Latin American countries are shifting to the left. Some are also describing that as anti-US and Western, in a sense. Is that characterization accurate? Brazil may also have a leftist politician as president. First, let's review some of the leftist politicians who have become presidents. the election of Mexico's leftist candidate López Obrador, in Argentina, the moderate-left Peronist candidate Alberto Fernández. Then there was Peru's election, which saw Pedro Castillo, a far-left teacher with no previous experience, come to power. In Chile, Gabriel Boric, a former student protest leader, became the youngest president in Chile's history to become president. Moving to Colombia, Gustavo Petro became the first leftist president in the country's history, and with the former Brazilian leader, Lula da Silva, expected to make a comeback in Brazil's elections this year, the picture would be complete for Latin America. The view from the outside is that this is clearly sending a message, and that is one for the US, which is not good news. This is one view, left-wing political victories across Latin America. A sign of U.S. repudiation could help southerly cooperation based on what some experts think. Snaps from key leaders at Summit of the Americas reveal Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in its neighborhood. And this became true when key Latin American leaders snubbed the U.S. and President Joe Biden when invited to the Summit of the Americas, described as the U.S. failing to assert its leadership. Biden lays out Latin America economic plan at summit marred by no-shows. Biden is seeking to present Latin American countries with an alternative to that calls for increased U.S. economic engagement, including more investment and building on existing trade deals. But how much has China invested in Latin America? In other words, is China investing heavily in South America? China has bought up so much copper, pork, and soy, and constructed so many roads, trains, power grids, and bridges that it surpassed the U.S. as South America's largest trade partner and is now the single biggest trader with Brazil, Chile, and Peru. In the case of just Brazil, Chinese companies invested a total of $5.9 billion in 2021, more than three times the U.S. $1.9 billion reported in 2020. A total of 28 projects and acquisitions made by Chinese companies were implemented in Brazil last year. And that does it for this section of the program.
The shift in Latin American countries to the left and away from the Western financial system is a result of their economies not really profiting from the Western capitalistic system. It's been going on for more than a decade, at a minimum. Now, who said this system in the first place should be a model for a prosperous economy anyways? Financial crisis, don't forget, proves this point. Well, with countries like China and trade blocs like the BRICS, the shift has already occurred politically and now economically. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Ikome Tafe and the team, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at traits and virtues that if I and you adopt, it should make us better human beings in terms of dealing with other people and maintaining their rights, I should say. So in the previous episodes, we mentioned a few, and today, inshallah, with the time we have, we want to mention a few others. One of the most important traits that we also need to have and need to train ourselves to have in terms of dealing with other people and maintaining their rights and maintaining human rights in general, is to be optimistic. And being optimistic is easy said than done. Again, with a lot of, as like any or many other concepts that we have. Being optimistic means that you look at the cup half full, not half empty. We live in a world where negativity seems to be the trend these days. Doom and gloom is the trend. Where people constantly negative, people constantly looking at the world in a dark sight, and they're looking at the world in a dark way, and there is as if there is no hope, humanity is doomed, we are doomed, and I'm doomed, and we, you know, you get the hint, right? So as human beings, we need to be optimistic. We need to have, as we say in Arabic, tafa'ul and amal. A believer, a mu'min, always looks at the bright side of things, not the dark side of things. Because looking at the dark side of things and looking at the negative aspects of things, it will definitely affect how I see myself and how I see other people. How many times have you heard from your friends or the people around you? They're constantly saying, humans like this, men like this, women like this, and we just keep dissing one another. We keep negatively blaming and complaining about one another. And we look at all the human beings in a bad eye. So sometimes one person does something wrong by me, and I generalize that to an entire race, our entire nation. And especially when we are traveling from one country to another country, and then you face one taxi driver who takes more than what he should have taken, and then I say, oh, these people, all thieves. That's just a negative way of looking at things. So it does affect. And when it does, and it takes over me, and then I start to generalize and try to blame an entire race or an entire group or what have you, then I'm actually oppressing them. Even from the perspective of jurisprudence, some of the ulama say this is a generalized riba. You're doing riba, backbiting, to an entire race. Why? Because you were so negative towards one person. Negativity in a mu'min, in a believer, is not required at the hardest of times, the worst of times. A person could be, he still needs to have the hope and optimism in things that will change. That's how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to be. Let us take a short break, and inshallah we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So just before the break, we were saying that the human being needs to be optimistic, needs to have a bit of hope in life, needs to look at the cup half full. Because having such mentality, it will make life a lot easier. Whatever problem I will face, if I have this mentality of being positive all the time and looking at things in a good way, it will ease my pain and my problems, especially when it comes to dealing with other people. Because the reality is, I don't live amongst angels. I don't live amongst prophets and infallibles. I live amongst humans. I live amongst the good and the bad, the believers and disbelievers, the good doers and the bad doers. So there's good and there's bad. And that's a fact we have to accept. When I come to deal with the bad ones, I need to have that optimism that things will change, things will be better. So looking at the bright side of things is actually a trait of the believers. It was narrated from Isa alayhi salam. He was walking with his disciples, and they saw a corpse, and they saw a corpse of a pig. And Isa said to them, "What do you see?" And each one of them was picking a negative aspect of that dead body. One said, "What an awful smell it has." One said, "What an awful look it has." And each one just kept saying, when they finished, he said to them, one of them asked him, "What do you see?" He said, "Look at how bright his teeth is." So Isa alayhi salam neglected and overlooked all the negative aspects of that pig, and he looked at the brightness of his teeth. That means positivity and being optimistic is a trait of the believers. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, or Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when he went to Ta'if, which is a city, far away from Medina or from Mecca, to preach Islam, he was welcomed with stones and sticks and children trying to harm him. And they threw so much stones at him, he was bleeding from head to toe. So he went and he sat under a tree. Jibreel came to him. He said to him, "Ya Rasulullah, I have an authority right now to demolish this entire city. I can flip it from head to toe. I can just destroy them with a blink of an eye for your sake. You give me the word and you see what I do to them." The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, he could have said, yeah, they were bad to me, do it. He said, no, don't do it. He said, "Oh Allah, forgive my people, for they do not know. أَخْفِرْ لِقَوْمِ فَأَنَّهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ They don't know. They don't know good from bad. They don't know what's good for them. They don't know who I am. They don't know this message of Islam. So it's natural for them to face me with this kind of... So I said, "Oh Allah, actually forgive my people." He said, "They are mine. Do not harm them." So that is what being optimistic is about. Being hopeful is all about. So when we look at one another, we need to look at each other with that kind of optimism and hopefulness. This trait should make this world a much better place. Inshallah, we will continue. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com
bit.ly/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.